The TNT Shop has great gift ideas for your furry family member. And we don't mean your Aunt Dolores.
You stink!
The TNT Shop has it all. At TNTRadio.live. You're listening to the No Fly Zone with Greg Maybury on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Hello, friends. Welcome to the No Fly Zone here on TNT Radio. I'm your host, Greg Maybury, and thanks once again for joining us. A recent image doing the rounds of social media, some of you may have seen it, showed the world's most famous whistleblower and leaker and political prisoner, Julian Assange, in what can only be described as a pretty pitiful, tragic state. This image depicted not just Assange's personal ideal, it also graphically portrays the unconscionable and criminal political persecution which presides over it. Assange's situation, for sure, stands out as perhaps the reigning symbol of everything by which we might measure America's decline and fall. And now, without some sort of divine intervention, may be as inevitable as it's irreversible. And given the large menu of metrics now on offer whereby we can calculate, then maybe predict such an outcome, this is probably one hell of a big call indeed. Today, our guest is Colleen Rowley. Colleen, along with being a whistleblower herself, has some firm views on the grave risks that such folks face and the treatment that's often meted out to them by their respective governments. She's a retired FBI special agent and former legal counsel of the Minneapolis division of the FBI. Beginning in May 2002, Colleen testified to the 9/11 Joint Intelligence Committee inquiry, the Senate Judiciary, and the Inspector General of the Department of Justice about the FBI's pre-9/11 intelligence lapses. She was chosen along with two other female whistleblowers as Time Magazine's Persons of the Year. And she retired in 2004, along with being an outspoken activist for peace and more cordial international relations. She speaks publicly on ethical decision-making to various groups. She is a writer and a blogger, in addition to being a member of the Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, the VIPS, and the Sam Adams Associates for Integrity. Now, while Colleen may or agree or disagree in part or in whole with the overall sentiments of my earlier introduction regarding her country's present malaise and possible future, I do know that she, like many of her compatriots, is gravely concerned about the direction in which America is heading, both on the home front and internationally. Colleen, welcome to the No Fly Zone. Great to have you on board.
Yep. Thanks a lot for waking me up in the middle of the night.
And again, that was my, you took the words right out of my mouth. I was going to say, I'm very grateful for you doing that, Colleen. It is a big ask of my stateside guests, particularly those on the East Coast side. It is a not a very civil hour, but we do appreciate the efforts that you have made to speak with us. Look, I wanted to start off by asking you to give us some personal background about your role with the FBI and the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks, particularly, which obviously led to your becoming a whistleblower. Your response, how did all that play out at the time?
Well, I had a pretty normal career. You know, anytime you're working inside a big agency with a lot of careerism, et cetera, you're going to start to spot problems. So towards the end of my 24 years, I had spotted the problem of the FBI's informant recruiting development, using criminals and even murderers, tried to make internal recommendations to curb that practice. You know, the well-known case is the Whitey Bulger fiasco, but that was basically the tip of the iceberg. Essentially I was the legal counsel in the Minneapolis office, and in 2001, you know, beginning in August 16, when agents arrested a Al-Qaeda suspect, called me at night at home and said, you know, what can we do? We just found this guy, gave me a quick briefing. And later, you know, a few weeks later, that turns into the attack on 9/11. Yeah. And here's the worst of it. Whenever there are mistakes like that, quote unquote, terrible mistakes, and, you know, 9/11, it turns out, could have been prevented or at least greatly reduced if the FBI had acted on all of the information that they had, including the Minneapolis case of finding someone learning to fly and had no rational reason for that, and all these other suspicions that his flight instructors, you know, two flight instructors called the FBI that he was the most suspicious student they had ever had, etc. So if the FBI had acted on this and shared the information, then itself, even with the Department of Justice and with others, and even publicly, not only, this isn't my opinion, this is the 9/11 inquiries, the actual official investigations, including the Department of Justice Inspector General, which launched a 2-year investigation based on my memo, and they found that that these were mistakes. But of course, after 9/11, this was all being covered up from the top down. These agencies just circle the wagons. And, you know, we've seen this many, many times, but I saw it personally with 9/11. And so a few months later, when the 9/11 joint committee was calling on me, I took that opportunity to write a long memo about the legal problems of not sharing that information and the fact that there was probable cause, which again had been all covered up for all those months, including from the FBI Director Mueller top down. And of course, this is just the beginning. As you well know, this is like where things start, because 9/11 then is used and exploited as the quote unquote new Pearl Harbor that then is used to launch a series of wars.
Of course, David Ray Griffin, who was one of the key 9/11 truthers, who passed away, I think, you know, last year, if I recall, he wrote a book actually called The New Pearl Harbor. And of course, that was something that the Project for the New American Century had called, was that before the events of 9/11, they were looking for some sort of a reason or a pretext for embarking on all of these adventures that subsequently came about in the wake of 9/11. That was also defined then as a, you know, something like an event like a new Pearl Harbor would be needed in order to shift public opinion in that direction. So, you know, those sorts of events, of course, have come to light for many of us, particularly now, so long, Colleen, after the event. I just want to hark back to one of the things that you mentioned. You were talking about the terrorists themselves receiving flight training and all of that sort of thing, and those scenarios of flying planes into buildings. Even though it was denied by people, or suggested that they had no way of knowing that airliners would be used as terrorist attacks, even that was pretty much a lie as well, wasn't it? Condoleezza Rice, I think, was one of many who had come out and said, look, you know, that we could not have known that people would use airliners to fly into buildings. Would you agree with that?
Yes, absolutely. They had even planned, Condoleezza Rice had even been involved in the planning of, I want to say it was a conference in Italy, where the presupposition was that planes would fly, could dive bomb into the place. And of course, this also came from one of the terrorists that was captured. I want to say also even a relative of the 9/11 mastermind, and there was a plot to fly planes into the CIA headquarters. So these plots had surfaced before. It, you know, Condoleezza Rice is very, very good, just as most of them are, at lying. And of course, she has the correct political identity, which everybody, you know, a black female, you know, beautiful, by the way, beautiful in her tailored suits. And she lies very well. And she lied about the torture program, you know, continues to lie about it. And by the way, she's become, with all of the resurrection of the Bush administration, she receives hundreds of thousands of dollars for each speech she gives on civil rights. She speaks on civil rights. Here in Minnesota, they paid her around $200,000 in a chartered jet, etc. And she spoke for 20 minutes. And here she was, one of the architects of the torture program. So you almost can't even envision a sitcom or, you know, fiction that is as crazy as what we've had. Going back to the new Pearl Harbor, you know, what this is, it's just a version of what Naomi Klein called the shock doctrine, or what Rahm Emanuel said, don't ever let a tragedy go to waste. We can always exploit that tragedy to do what we want to do. Because when you have people that are traumatized by some terrible, quote unquote, Pearl Harbor or 9/11 or even the hurricane that hit New Orleans, et cetera, anything at all, you can use that. And this is very crass political, you know, I don't know even how to, you can't even describe how evil that is. It's such a crass political calculation to exploit the trauma of people. And of course, even Naomi Klein with the shock doctrine doesn't understand that the COVID virus was exactly the same.
And even exactly the same. Cold, yes.
It's amazing. It's just amazing how effective it is. And, it's so effective that when they wanted to launch the war on Iraq that had zero factual relationship to 9/11. In fact, Saddam Hussein was an enemy of Al-Qaeda.
Yeah.
He was a complete enemy. They got 70% of the American public to believe that Iraq was behind 9/11. That's how these narratives and this propaganda and exploitation of trauma work so effectively. You can get people to believe anything. And I will just say, once they were able to make their own reality with Iraq, when they launched the campaign to say Iraq was behind 9/11, and they pulled it out because we want to go to war on Iraq and we're going to use this as a series of justifications for war, they laughed amongst themselves that they could, quote unquote, make their own reality. And that's been the case ever since. Now we're living with it.
Yeah, that was Karl Rove, I think, was quoted as being the person that's saying that, you know, we create our own realities and you guys are just bystanders or something along those lines. You know, that was an extraordinary statement to come out with, for sure. And I agree with you. I'm glad you brought up the COVID situation by way of corollary or by way of a comparison, if you like. Colleen, we've seen pretty much that same sort of thing play out with the declaration of the pandemic. In fact, I read a wonderful article about 18 months ago, and if you haven't seen it, I'll send you along a link to it. But Piers Robinson, who's a commentator on propaganda, he wrote a very, very interesting article comparing the events of 9/11 to the events of COVID. And, you know, there were a lot of sort of overlaps between the two in terms of how propaganda was used and how censorship was used and how, you know, the powers that be created this particular narrative that they wanted people to buy into. And of course, you know, as you said, you mentioned the figure of 70%. It was probably roughly about the same kind of percentage that bought into the COVID narrative. The COVID thing is probably something I'd prefer to sort of leave for another time. I know you've got your own views on that, and I think we're probably going to run out of time in terms of talking about that. I'd like to just go back to, we've got to go for a break just in a couple of minutes and we can continue this after the break, but I really wanted to focus on your experience as a whistleblower. I mentioned Julian Assange in the introduction and I want to sort of get your views on people like Assange, but your own experience as a whistleblower, what did you must have gone through a difficult process in deciding whether to sort of go public with your views. Can you give us a bit of a sense of what you went through when you saw there was something wrong with the way that information was communicated prior to the 9/11 attacks?
Well, in the months preceding that opportunity to talk to the Joint Intelligence Committee, our office, it wasn't just me, it was actually the investigating agents. They had tried and tried. They had a meeting with headquarters just a month or two after 9/11. And, you know, headquarters told them, we're sticking with our story. They had tried enough. It's really complicated. Even in communications with other offices, the agents were trying to get the truth out. But again, when you're up against power, it's very, very difficult. The agents that were really good and astute in acting on the flight instructor whistleblowers, by the way, those were the first two whistleblowers about 9/11, were these flight instructors that both independently called the FBI. And, you know, they were going against their bosses because the bosses didn't want to go against any paying customer, despite the suspicions, you know. So the agents were young. They only had a couple years in. And our headquarters had twisted this into what they called the legal wall, preventing between intelligence and criminal matters. And since I was the legal counsel in the office, I kind of felt responsible to debunk that part of it, which is that, you know, there were problems, and it was largely due to the people in Washington, D.C., that those problems, the wall existed. And so even to this day, very few people will understand why the New York agent was not allowed to even search for the two Al-Qaeda suspects that eventually they found out had come into California. He was told no, he couldn't even search for them. I mean, people don't understand that. So they were using this artifice of the wall, and it was a misunderstanding on the part of high-level officials in the Department of Justice, a mixture of things. Well, I felt like since I was the legal counsel that at least I could explain that a little better. And so that's why I wrote the memo. I was lucky, I should say, I was very lucky because, you know, all of the whistleblowers that came after the so-called new Pearl Harbor and the exploitation of shock doctrine to launch war after war after war. And there's a whole series of former CIA and other, like a John Kiriakou and a whole bunch of other people. They were put in prison. Okay, so for going up against power and trying to debunk the official line narrative, obviously, Julian Assange, one of the bravest people to publish these war crimes and everything else, you are going to be attacked and actually imprisoned. The drone assassination program. Our Sam Adams Association has given awards to these brave whistleblowers that followed my example. And it wasn't just my example. You can go back to, you know, Daniel Ellsberg back during the Vietnam War, who, by the way, we just gave the Sam Adams Award to Daniel Ellsberg. He only has weeks to live. And so you can find that on my Facebook that I just posted the video of our
We've
thing.
We've got to go to a break.
Bottom line,
sorry to interrupt.
I was lucky to survive, and I did not get fired. I was even lucky that way because I had four senators that wrote to the attorney general that I shouldn't be fired and wrote to the FBI director. It took four senators to tell my bosses not to fire me. However, I managed to make it to retirement. I did have to step down when I also tried to tell facts about the Iraq war. And so I had to step down from my position as legal counsel. I did suffer that problem. And it's excruciating to go up against power. You, as you well know, it's very difficult, and you have to be prepared for some very severe consequences, including now going to prison for telling the truth.
Yes, exactly. Colin, we have to go to a quick break. Hold that thought. We will come back because this is a topic that I want to pursue just for a little bit longer. And it's one that is obviously, you know, has clear ramifications, not just for the here and now, but for the future as well. Folks, you are listening to the No Fly Zone. I'm speaking with Colleen Rowley. We're just going to take a short break, and we'll be back in a moment.
TNT Radio's Ross Cameron.
The mayor of New York City says that the illegal immigration crisis has, quote, destroyed his city, and noted that the Biden administration had done nothing to help with the problem they had created. Mayor Adams' comments came one day after he signed an executive order which extended the state of emergency in New York City over the influx of illegal migrants. Quote, the city now faces an unprecedented humanitarian crisis that requires it to take extraordinary measures. According to city comptroller Brad Lander, in an April 7 report, the city has had to ramp up its provisions for shelter by over 75% due to the influx of more than 55,000 foreigners claiming to be seeking asylum over the past year. Meanwhile, the mayor's Office of Management and Budget says the full cost of providing shelter and other services to refugees is around $1.4 million this year, will be $2.8 billion in 2024.
Ross Cameron on TNT Radio.
This is a message for the parents of young children in the United States. I am Dr. Tess Laurie from the World Council for Health. Please consider the danger of vaccinating your children and babies with the COVID-19 injections. They are not the same as traditional vaccines and are causing significant harm to children around the world. Your children have their whole lives ahead of them. They are not endangered by COVID at all. Please hear us when we say, for your children, it is much safer to wait. Thank you.
A cashless society means zero cash. No car boot sales. No markets. No tooth fairy or piggy banks. No saving cash for a rainy day. No buying anything with privacy. Digital currency means every cent you receive will be recorded and every transaction tracked. Lighting the fuse for freedom. TNT Radio.
Hello, folks. Welcome back to the No Fly Zone. I'm Greg Mabry. I'm speaking with Colleen Rowley, who is a former special agent and legal counsel for the FBI. She was also a whistleblower. Colleen, we were speaking before the break about the lot of the whistleblower and the leakers, and people who, you know, do stand up for good reasons to alert the public or alert the authorities, appropriate authorities, to corruption or conflicts of interest or, you know, deception in government decision-making and government activity. And we've been talking, obviously, about the 9/11 experience, but in more general terms, when people are working, particularly in the national security and intelligence and law enforcement areas, they've become much more politicized over the years, particularly since 9/11, although, you know, there are plenty of examples of this occurring before 9/11. But can you speak to the politicization of how intelligence is gathered, how it is presented, and how that is used in your experience, and also just, you know, going on your own knowledge and understanding of what others have gone through in this process?
And I will add that throughout history, the worst times of politicization seem to occur during wars. Obviously, you had this in World War One, World War Two, the Vietnam War, and the Vietnam War, which is the biggest war before the current post 9/11 wars. You had, you know, this McCarthyism that began during the Cold War that then morphed into COINTELPRO.
Yes.
So the agencies are seen as the, you know, they have to support the official narratives. So during Vietnam, there was all these lies as well. And that's why the FBI then was tasked with infiltrating the various groups that formed to try to, you know, counter the Vietnam War. The same thing is repeating now. At the height of war, you will always have this tendency to suppress dissent. You always lose your whatever democracy you had before the war began. You start to lose that. And the agencies then become tasked with the problem. That doesn't mean that everyone in the agency goes along with it. You now certainly have a number of people quitting the FBI and trying to become whistleblowers. The media, which is part of this large Mickey Mat, was the term coined by Ray McGovern, one of our VIPs and Sam Adams associates.
I know, Ray.
Which stands for Military Industrial Congressional Intelligence Media Academia Think Tank Complex. Okay,
yes.
Mickey Mat. So it's a lot more than just the MIC. It's grown into a behemoth monster.
Exactly.
At this point. Far worse than even Eisenhower could have imagined. And
I haven't
heard
the Mickey Mat's expression before, but yeah, go on.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
I haven't heard that Mickey Mat's thing. I do know that when apparently Eisenhower's original speech on the military-industrial complex included the military-industrial congressional complex, but that's about as far as I ever knew that it went. But, of course, that didn't appear in the official speech. For some reason, that congressional bit was taken out. But the Mickey Mat's thing, of course, that you've just alluded to has taken it to a whole new level. And I think most of us can certainly understand that it's not just military-industrial power we're talking about here. It goes right across the board.
Yeah, it's captured our all of our mainstream media to the point where the censorship now of even presidential candidates and social media, the censorship is incredible. So yes, the media is part of it. And even the universities, which all get their money from a lot of it from the military industrial complex and big pharma, et cetera. So they get their money. So it eventually, during a time of war, when these narratives are necessary to demonize and to gain public support, as I said, you're able to fool 70% of the people completely factually counter to what the facts are. You know, when you're able to do that and you get so full of yourself that you think, oh, we can just run ramshod over public opinion. We can create our own public, you know, make people think what we want them to think, no matter what the truth is. And that's what has happened, not in the FBI, this politicization of the Washington, D.C., I would say within the Beltway. I don't think it affects so much people out in the, for instance, in the FBI, there's field offices. And I think there's a lot of good employees. They don't know what to do. I mean, they're not going to risk their retirement and their employment. Most of them aren't. There's been a few that have quit and resigned and become whistleblowers. And you know, the thing is now you're even facing, as Daniel Hale, one of the military people that was in the drone program, you know, you're even facing prison time. Obviously, if you're Julian Assange and you're a publisher or a reporter, you're going to be facing imprisonment. And that's not even only in the United States. That's the whole world, because the United States,
absolutely,
led by example, of claiming that foreign journalists could, like a Julian Assange, could be imprisoned for telling the truth. And now other countries are following that example. So the whole thing is degenerating. The blowback from war is so bad that after 20 some years, and now of course the worst part of this is it's led right up to the eve of nuclear destruction by targeting nuclear superpowers. And, you know, again, these people that are so hell-bent on full spectrum dominance, you know, the United States has to be the hegemon in control of the world and enforce the international law, even though the United States doesn't follow any international law itself.
Exactly,
You know, when this happens, you're living in a really challenging environment. It's happened before during time of war. You know, Debs went to prison for his opposition to
Eugene
World
Debs.
War One.
Yep. He's something of an iconic figure in terms of those people who, you know, stand up to and speak up, speak truth to power in times of war. And but yeah, he's interesting. You've actually brought up something that interests me. You sent something along to me as part of an email thread, and it had to do, and it harks back to your discussions about, or your mentioning of, you know, the provocations of Russia and that. And it had to do with Medvedev, the former president of Russia, declaring or restating, if you like, Russia's nuclear weapons policy, which, you know, is, this thread went on to say that it's more clearly defined than the US's first use doctrine. Russia's doctrine says that it is prepared to use nuclear weapons if the very existence of the state is put under threat, quote unquote. Now, well, I found that very interesting, and it harks back to those comments that you were making earlier on, that this is where America and its allies, NATO, et cetera, and even Australia, supporting, you know, American policy. This is, and I'm quoting here from this feed that you sent me, this is an interesting observation. This is the central contradiction in the West's determination to defeat Russia. The goal of weakening Russia to the point that it becomes subservient to the US empire does represent an existential threat to Russia as an independent country. Russia has fought several wars for its existence and independence against Napoleon, the Kaiser in World War I, and then on to the Nazis and throughout the Cold War. So this is not a hypothetical question to Medvedev, Putin, or the Russian government. Of course, the big factor here, Colleen, I'm sure you would agree, is the involvement or the potential use of, you know, nuclear weapons. The finishing line, though, of that particular thread went on to say that if Biden's wannabe world conquerors, that's the full spectrum dominance people that you mentioned too, think this is some kind of bluff, we are in serious trouble. What are your thoughts on that? You sent that through to me. I imagine you probably would concur with that. Can you add a little bit to that, though, that comment?
I think we are living right now, basically just like that old song, on the eve of destruction.
Yeah.
It only takes a spark. It could even be a miscalculation or a misunderstanding to set off a chain of nuclear bombs that's going to basically end the world. You know, I've been telling people, asking them if they watch the movie, Don't Look Up. Which is about an asteroid going to hit the world, and the fact that these scientists and whistleblowers are not able to convince people in time. And,
right,
you know,
this
is the moment we're living in. We're living, yeah. We're kind of playing out that movie. And, you know, you can't believe that if you are threatening nuclear war, as the United States has done for decades, and pushing and pushing and pushing, and then the other nuclear superpower says, you can't push us any further because our very existence is threatened, that you don't have this really, really dangerous environment. We're lucky, frankly, to be alive right now. There's been accidents before. There's been mistaken notions that a flock of geese or a radar blip was a nuclear bomb, and the protocol would have required the beginning of launching nuclear weapons, I think at least a half dozen times in the history. And by the way, it was the Russian side that actually was more careful. They were the more careful ones who did not follow their own protocol to launch nuclear war, or we wouldn't even be talking right now. This has happened in the past, and actually it happened during times that were not even as scary and tense as they are right now. So yes, here's the problem. The Blinkens, the Sullivans, this group of neocon war hawks in Washington are so full of hubris that they have deluded themselves into believing that they can launch nuclear, what they call tactical nuclear bombs on another superpower, and that there will be no retaliation. They actually believe this. This runs counter to what was the old theory of mutually assured destruction. Yeah, this was supposed to be... This kept us from going there, because it was like, if we bomb them, they're going to bomb us back. Now, this group thinks, no, we're so great and powerful and wonderful. We're God's gift to the world. We have to control the world. And so if we launch a tactical nuke on another nuclear superpower, they're just bluffing. They will not launch anything back. This is how sickeningly, I don't even know how to say it. We've had people so full of their own pride that they're blind to reality. And that's what's in Washington, D.C. We have that right now. Very sad. I don't know what we can do about it other than what they did in the Don't Look Up movie, which is at the end of the movie, they can at least tell themselves that they've tried, you know, instead of just walking blindly into this.
Yeah, it's I agree. The acronym that came from Mutually Assured Destruction, of course, is appropriate. It was called MAD, as it came to be known, and it certainly puts a whole new spin on MAD when they're in such a delusional state of mind now that they think, as you say, that they can push the button at Russia and Russia will not retaliate. I mean, the history of Russia defending itself should be enough for these people to go on with. But we have to go to a short break in a moment, Colleen. So we'll come back to that because I want to talk a little bit more about, you know, who are these people in Washington that are really driving, the driving forces behind U.S. foreign policy and, you know, its geopolitical ambitions that we've seen play out, particularly since 9/11. We're going to go to a quick break, people. I'm speaking here with Colleen Rowley, from former FBI agent and whistleblower. We're going to take a quick break, as I said, and we'll be back shortly.
With his expert analysis and opinion, this is TNT Radio's Timothy Shea.
If you had Susan Rice, Don Lemon, and Tucker Carlson in your Monday media trifecta, you win! What a day! Susan Rice. Is she gone from the White House because she's going to move over to the campaign and perhaps even as Joe's Veep? Or was she bounced because she could no longer cover up for the Biden crime family? That CNN cut ties with Don Lemon isn't as surprising as the fact that they didn't do it 6 months ago, or a year ago, or 5 years ago. And Tucker Carlson, why would Fox News bounce its number one rated show? Some are saying that Rupert Murdoch is old and makes random decisions. I'm not buying that. I think it's because on Friday, Tucker bit the hand that feeds Fox. He called out Quisling broadcasters who pushed the COVID lies to benefit their big pharma advertisers. If anything, this demonstrates the power of Pfizer. Tucker will be fine. Fox News, I think they're in for rocky days ahead. From MAGAInstitute.com, this is Timothy Shea for TNT Radio.
Unlike other health concerns, mental illness is not always easy to see. Depression won't show up on an eye chart, and you won't find PTSD by looking at a thermometer. Sorting out a mental health concern takes professional diagnosis and treatment. Anxiety won't just go away under a bandage. If you or a loved one has a mental health concern, call 1-800-662-HELP for free and confidential information and treatment referral. Learn more at samhsa.gov/support.
This is the No Fly Zone with Greg Maybury on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Hello, listeners. Welcome back to the No-Fly Zone. I'm Greg Maybury. I'm speaking today with Colleen Rowley, former FBI agent and whistleblower. Colleen, before the break, we were talking about, obviously, the continuing sort of standoff between US and the West and Russia in particular. And, of course, China is very much a part of that sort of divide. In respect of Russia in particular, where do you see all this heading down the track? We've got the Ukraine war that's happening at the moment, and if anything is going to trigger this all-out kind of world war that may or may not involve nuclear weapons, how do you see this playing out in the foreseeable?
I don't think anyone is capable, has the type of, I don't care what great intelligence analysts they are, there's no one capable of predicting the future. And the reason for that, and by the way, that's where the hope lies. The hope lies in no one being capable. And that includes the Washington, D.C. War hawk elites that are pushing for this. They don't know either. They're following an agenda that began in the 1990s, the PNAC, the Cheney, yeah, the Pentagon plan to retain unipolar dominance. So they're following this old playbook that's been going on now for 30, 40 years. Yeah. However, that doesn't mean it's going to happen. That doesn't mean, because things are falling apart. In the United States, we have all kinds of domestic issues, including the violence in the streets. These, yeah, are all blowbacks, as Chalmers Johnson wrote years ago. He wrote a book called Blowback, in predicting, yeah, he was very accurate in predicting that when you start these wars, you're going to get all kinds of problems back. And that's what's happening in the United States. So that means that mistakes are constantly occurring. And that the people, even though they are pretty, you know, effectively propagandized through pressing their emotional vulnerabilities, they are, yeah, you know, they are led a lot. However, there is a growing distrust in authority in this censorship regime. And there are good people speaking out. I think the other thing that is happening, and again, this makes it impossible to predict outcomes, even though we are living in this dangerous moment, I don't think anyone really knows what's afoot. One of the other things that happens are people in power actually differ in their agendas. And so you have the world globalization effort going on one hand. Yeah. You have the United States military industrial Mickey Mat group seeking world dominance. These things are not perfectly in sync with each other. There's not, like in a James Bond movie, just one overall uniform monolithic agenda. And I always think, well, maybe there's some hope, because these power mongers will often then be fighting amongst themselves. And that's where, you know, the average person then can maybe see what's going on, because you have different people with different agendas. I mean, that's kind of a very, what's the word? That's a low bar, you know, in, yeah, a way. That's a very sad thing to take your hope from, the fact that the power mongers are fighting with each other. But I think that's what we have left, because the centers, at least inside of an empire like the United States, the centers of power are very controlled. And so, yes, at this point, they are firing anyone who goes against the official narrative. They're censoring. They're trying to imprison whistleblowers. But it's not necessarily completely working. There, you know, our little group of VIPs and stuff, we try. One of our latest efforts now is to try with Daniel Ellsberg. Again, in his last weeks on Earth, he is reiterating the same message that he did during Vietnam. Don't wait as long as I did. If you, yeah, are an insider and you know the truth of what's going on, don't wait as long as I did. He beats himself up for going a few years before it really dawned on him about all of the lies of Vietnam. I've actually, you know, argued with him a couple of times and said, well, you know, that's pretty much what's human. You know, you're a genius, and yet it took you a few years to realize this. I think Tucker Carlson is in a kind of in the similar, yeah, thing. I think he kind of changed in the last year or two when he started interviewing really smart people like Robert Kennedy and Glenn Greenwald, and he started, yeah, interviewing, yeah, people, and I think eventually he started to see the light. And so, yes, we're trying to get that message out so that people, insiders in government, will, when they realize the dangerous situation and the lies going on, that they will not wait, you know, that they will put out the truth. We'll see, you know, if that happens. I mean, we've had some, you know, whistleblowers that were brave. It's not very many Edward Snowden types, but, you know, yeah, every once in a while, somebody comes along who really knows that they can't live with themselves if they go along with this kind of banality of evil and this destruction that has happened, where millions of people are being killed. That's what got me to write against the Iraq War. even though I was on the cover of Time magazine, etc., I was being touted. And I knew that was not going to be a popular thing when you had the whole country with war fever. But you know what? You're not going to be able to live with yourself. So what's the difference? People are committing suicide in the United States for having gone along with the war agenda. Destruction and all these lies. So if you, at the very least, you have to be able to live with yourself. And we're trying to get that message out that Daniel Ellsberg said, don't wait, you know, tell the truth.
Yeah, this situation of, and I wake up one day and wake up the next with differing views on each day. One day I wake up and, yes, the message is getting out there, whether it's to do with, America's foreign policy and how that's impacting on the world, whether it's to do with what's happening with COVID and the Great Reset and all of this sort of stuff. And, you know, I sometimes wake up and I think, well, you know, yeah, people are really starting to kind of, you know, get the message. And then other days I wake up and then I, God, maybe they are, but tell you what, not enough people are getting the message fast enough. So I'm sort of waxing and waning in between both of those. But it is gratifying, Colleen, to hear you speak about there being hope. And this message that you're putting through that these people aren't completely and totally united. And it sometimes sounds as if, you know, in certain actions that they're taking, that they're actually becoming very, very desperate in terms of, what they're trying to achieve, you know, and, you know, particularly in relation to its provocations of Russia and even China as well, that they, you know, that the war hawks, as you call them, and are really becoming extremely desperate. My feeling is generally they do know that America is on the slide. And that it's going to be, you know, and I think they've dug themselves into a hole that's too deep that they can't get themselves out of. That's even if we assume that they realize that they're in that hole. And speaking of that hole, what I wanted to speak with you about was, you know, who are the people? One of the things that's been of major concern to me is the actual people who have been driving American foreign policy and its, you know, military actions since 9/11 particularly has been these so-called neocons. What's your position on these people? I mean, clearly a lot of these people have strong ties to Israel, and we all know that Israel has significant influence over American foreign policy and to a large degree over its domestic policy. And people like, you know, you mentioned Ray McGovern earlier on and Philip McGeraldi, who you would know, of course. These people have been very critical of Israel's role and influence in American foreign policy. What's your take on Israel's involvement in and influence on American policy and how that's playing out on the geopolitical stage?
And let me just quickly follow up on your comment about desperation of the people who have their fingers on the nuclear button. The problem with their desperation, which is, you know, akin to Hitler in the bunker at the end. Yep. When that happens, they become more reckless. And so you have this recklessness that's been interjected. And that's the most dangerous thing. This isn't cool, calm decision-making. No. This is born of recklessness and desperation. And that's what makes it so dangerous. And like yes,
they're acting as if they've got nothing left to lose.
That's right. That's right. And that's the, I think that they aren't. Silly enough to not see this blowback that's happening and the economic peril and everything else that's going on. Instead of being more of a again cool, calm, collected intelligence analyst, they're not even following that. You probably have some dissidents right now amongst the intelligence analysts, just as happened during Vietnam, who are the ones telling the truth. And their bosses, of course, these neocon war hawks, are not going to listen. But anyway, going back to the Israel, I used to always write that the empire was the U.S., NATO, Israel. And almost in some ways, Israel is the tail that wags the dog.
Yeah,
and some,
exactly.
And certainly in all of the post 9/11 series of wars in the Mideast, that was the case. Now with the nuclear superpowers and the U.S. now trying to confront Russia and China. Israel seems to have gone more on, this is again geopolitical analysis here, they have gone more on the fence in an opportunistic way. They are trying to hedge their bets because I think that there are Israeli power mongers who also see now that this problem of the blowback on the United States, and you know, like, oh, are we going to continue to hitch our wagon solely to the United States, or are we going to like look out there? Who's the power? I think this is what's going on. You see this with you know, Israel not fully joining in on the war on Ukraine. And also with, you know, with China making the inroads, with Saudi Arabia, things have changed a lot since these post 9/11 wars in the Mideast, where essentially, yes, it was Israel, their impetus for, you know, separating the countries that surround Israel. They wanted to weaken and divide and conquer. And I think that's all that's gone through a metamorphosis in this last bid here, where the United States is confronting nuclear superpowers.
Well, of course, in Ukraine, that's taken the whole gambit right out of the Middle East. It's in Eastern Europe, of course, and they're dealing with nuclear powers, as you say. But certainly, I would agree with you there that Israel has been relatively quiet, although no doubt, obviously, Israel and the neocons have been very key to what's actually happening in the Ukraine, going back to 2014 with Victoria Nuland and her crowd that brought about and instigated the coup, which again, a lot of people don't realize. A lot of people seem to think it's Russia's just invaded Ukraine out of the blue. And of course, there's no backstory there. But again, getting back to the neocons, they were actually principal in instigating much of what's already happening in Ukraine at the moment. So in that sense, Colleen, they really are involved, are they not? Or they're certainly at least responsible for a lot of what's happening over there at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. The neocons domestically in the United States, who are, you know, affiliated with the Israel lobby, strongly affiliated with the Israel lobby, which has now captured both parties. It had captured them before, but now to have turned the Democrat Party into the party of war, actually even more so than the Republican Party.
I totally agree with that.
This totally is the case inside the United States. When I was speaking about the opportunism and the fact that Israel itself is hedging and looking at who's got the power out there, what, you know, who are we going to support with the power? This has changed in Israel. I think, you know, Netanyahu and is disappointed that he's, you know, doesn't seem to be able to totally control the United States, some of it anymore. Although when we get into a political campaign, we're going to see the presidential candidates. We just saw DeSantis go to Israel. And, you know, just as Trump got Adelson's support, you know, I've got to get Netanyahu and Adelson's support. And why is that? That's because of power and money. I know it's politically impossible to say that in the United States. If you say it, you're going to be thrown into the burned as a witch, you know. Yeah. But it is about power and money. The first person who would agree, you know, are not only the Walt Mearsheimers, but Zbigniew Brzezinski knows it's kind of a Machiavellian. You know, it's about power. And, you know, there's nobody who understands that better than the people in Washington, D.C. and these war hawks.
Yeah. And of course, again, while they continue to pursue this power, particularly again, getting back to Ukraine and getting back into an area where what we might call a nuclear theater, you know, where you've got, you know, Russia, who has basically said, now, hang on, if we feel threatened, we have nukes and, you know, we are prepared to use them if you push us too far. If we feel threatened to that degree, we will use them. They've basically been put on notice. But of course, the neocons, they've known this for ages anyway. And it's now, they've kept pushing and pushing, and now it's playing. The neocons, they've known this for ages anyway, and it's now, they've kept pushing and pushing, and now it's playing out the way that it has done. Colin, we're going to have to finish up in a couple of minutes. I just want to, just to sort of round things out a bit and getting back to the FBI and I guess more generally about the security intelligence profession and law enforcement. Where do you see, do you see that there will be more whistleblowers, more people standing up to speak truth to power in the foreseeable future? We've got a couple of minutes left to go, about a minute.
You know, again, I don't have a crystal ball. I think that as things become more desperate, there is a chance that there will be people of conscience. And there could be even these so-called accidental leaks like this last one, which actually are pretty valuable for purposes of understanding the situation, even though it was an accidental and it wasn't a deliberate leak. So I think that we have things falling apart. And that's no one can predict what's going to result when things are falling apart. But obviously they're reckless.